I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And I'm also joined today by our new co-host, Jeremy Hobson. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, Robin. Great to be here.
He's going to be here the whole hour as we gear up for the expanded Here and Now, which begins July 1st. Very exciting. But Jeremy, you bring a story for us?
I do. From Chicago, it's been a terribly violent few days there. And we're going to talk with some people that are right in the thick of things about what is going on and what needs to be done.
Okay, we'll have that in a couple of minutes. But first, at that rare open House Intelligence Committee hearing today, government officials and lawmakers defended surveillance programs. FBI Deputy Director Sean Joyce outlined four terrorist plots he claimed were foiled by the NSA programs revealed by leaker Edward Snowden. NSA Chief Keith Alexander said he had 50 examples of thwarted attacks that he will hand over to Congress. And he said, let the debate over his surveillance programs begin.
Let me start by saying that I would much rather be here today debating this point than trying to explain how we failed to prevent another 9/11.
Let's bring in Siobhan Gorman, intelligence correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Siobhan, last week we heard about New York subway and Times Square attacks that were thwarted by these surveillance programs. What were the attacks outlined today?
They were two additional ones. One was a plot against the New York Stock Exchange, and another was one that was a little bit less precise. It had to do with information on an individual that the FBI had opened a case on shortly after 9/11 and then had decided to close the case, and then apparently information came in later from the NSA that led FBI to open that case again. But Mr. Joyce was not very specific about the contours of that particular case.
What else?
He did tie that directly to the broad collection of phone records and the searches of those.
What else did we hear in the hearings today?
Well, we heard an interesting discussion about this question of how would a system administrator actually gain access to such sensitive documents. And while it doesn't seem that NSA has a complete answer to that yet, it does seem that they are now making a tally of who has access to what types of things. And we heard from General Alexander that there are roughly 100 or so system administrators that are in a position akin to Mr. Snowden's, and the majority of them, I'm sorry, did I say 100? I meant 1,000. And the majority of them are contractors.
Well, we also know that there's a FISA court, a court that oversees this use of people's phone records and also the internet records. And some lawmakers question whether that FISA court just went along with whatever was asked of it. You've told us in the past that the most recent warrant to use phone records was actually something that was being reenacted. Here's Deputy Attorney General James Cole responding to that question of rubber stamping.
This is by no means a rubber stamp. There is an enormous amount of work, and they make sure, they're the ones to make sure that the privacy and the civil liberty interests of United States citizens are honored. They're that bulwark in this process.
And Siobhan, it seems that the officials who were testifying seem to also go out of their way to say they did not listen in on Americans.
Yes, that's true, and that has been a common talking point from all government officials on these two programs, and as far as we can tell, that is certainly the case. The phone records are indeed just records. They're not phone conversations from millions of Americans that are being stored by NSA. In the case of the Internet Communications Program, that is targeted at foreign intelligence targets, so that's definitely the case, and one of the things that officials were seeking today was to reinforce that message to counter any misperceptions that these were listening in on conversations of Americans. They really went overboard in trying to talk about, you know, what they see as a limited system with lots of internal and to some degree external checks and balances.
Siobhan Gorman, intelligence correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, in Chicago, there have been several more shootings since this past weekend, the city's bloodiest ever. 7 people killed, 41 injured. It was only last week that a front-page New York Times story proclaimed killings down in Chicago because of extra police patrols. In 2009, Donzel Mintz, a teenager from the city's south side, told us about a fight that just erupted between friends.
I was saying, at least I ain't dead. I was thinking like this, thinking all the other people that died. I was just real sad, though, because right before I got hit with the bottle, my friend, he was talking to me. He was crying. It was like an emotional moment, like, what was going on? We supposed to have been all friends.
Well, as we said, Jeremy Hobson has an update. And, Jeremy, things seem to only get worse for him.
They did, which was a bit of a surprise, Robin, because we wanted to go to Chicago to talk to him to find out about the violence in Chicago from someone who had actually been involved in it, who maybe has a better sense of what's going on. But I found Donzel Mintz at a cafe in Evanston, just north of Chicago, a cafe that's run by a woman named Susan, who we're going to hear from in a moment. But as it turns out, Donzel, now 21 years old, just got out of prison.
I currently moved to Evanston on parole so I could be away from Chicago because I feel like that's the root of all my problems.
What do you mean that's the root of all your problems in Chicago?
Because I was born and raised in Chicago, and I adapt to my environment really, really well. And, you know, like, Chicago is a really, like, rough place, tough place. So I became a rough, tough individual, and you can't fight fire with fire because everybody will get burned.
So what have you been doing here?
At Kurt's Cafe, they train you in all positions in the restaurant. So when you do go and try to apply for a restaurant, like at an Olive Garden, on your resume it'll say you've been trained to be a busboy, cash register, cook. People that already have a career come in and talk to the employees about how their career choice and how they went about making their career. Like, I want to be an elevator installer, and Susan said she'll have an elevator installer come in and talk to the group.
When did you decide to do that? Because I think last time we heard from you on the show, you were interested in being a parole officer.
Yeah. Well, right now, I'm on parole. I'm a felon now. And when I was locked up, I read a book called Jobs for Ex-Felons. And when I read the book, it had all of the jobs I can apply for, even though I have a felony on my record. So it said elevator installing, and they get paid a nice penny and everything. And it's apprenticeship, so you get paid to learn to do it. And everything, it says sound nice, and I wanted to go about that.
So why did you end up going to jail?
At the time, I got into an altercation with my sister, baby father. He accused me of taking something from him, and my sister took his side and kicked me out the house. So at the time I was a senior, I went to our alternative school was called Second Chance. I was a senior there, and everything was going good until that happened, and I felt like my back was against the wall and nobody wanted to help me because I wanted to go to the Navy after I graduated high school. But I felt like nobody was with me, so I decided to try to rob somebody and wind up getting caught and wind up having to do 3 years.
3 years?
Yes, I've been locked up since 2010 to 2013. I came home 30 days from the day, May the 6th. It's June the 6th.
Today is June the 6th, yeah.
30 days from the day. And since I've been out, I've been signed up for Youth Job Center on Church Street. I became a part of Kurt's Cafe. I just had a job interview with Chipotle, and they liked me so much they told me to come back and give them a speech on Chipotle, and I gave them a speech. They liked it again, so they told me to come back Saturday for an interview at Lincolnwood. You know?
That's great.
Yeah, so every, like, 30 days I've been out, I've been waking up every day at 6 o'clock and getting out there and try to build my foundation.
Did you feel in prison that was a fair thing that it was happening to you, or it was an unfair thing that was happening to you based on what you had done to get in there?
I say it was fair because I always say if you do the crime, you have to do the time. I knew when I was trying to rob somebody that I can get caught and do the time, but I took that chance upon myself. So every day in there, I was miserable because, like, I'm doing time because I knew I did what I was there for. So I can't say it was unfair because I deserve what I got.
So do you feel like this is your last chance?
I feel like probably not my last chance, but I can say this. I feel like my last chance because I've been through so much. You know, I've been a little DOC. Now just came home from the big DOC. I have the best support system I ever had in my life. Everybody's like helping me out with everything I need and setting everything up. And now I'm a part of Kurt's Cafe, which they're helping me build myself up. And I'm doing the classes at Youth Job Center every day to build my resume up. So right now I feel like I got a foundation that I'm building, and I have a support system. Whenever I need help, they'll help me with. So if I fail now, I'm letting not just my family down, but my mentors, my friends, and everyone else.
Well, what would be your message to other people who are in the position that you were in 3 years ago, where you feel like things are stacked against you, nobody's listening to you, and you are on the verge of making a decision that you're going to regret afterwards?
I'll tell them to look around and go through everything and see do they have anybody to talk to. If they don't, go on the internet and find a community center, because right now I'm trying to get my sister in a community center and get a mentor to talk, you know. People out there, they just doing it just because they see him doing it. But once they see him come home with a McDonald's suit and him come home with a car that he's paying car notes on, they'll look up to him. They don't have any positive role models to look up to. The role models they looking up to is rappers and movie stars that was on a gangster movie. But once you start getting the grants flowing, like summer jobs, part-time jobs, you know, and they'll start seeing their older brothers and sisters got a job at 16. Now they gonna be like, I can't wait till I turn 16 so I can get a job. You start off right there and better the schools. I'll say, like, it won't be perfect, but it'll be better than what it is now.
Well, Donzel Mintz, thank you so much for talking, and best of luck to you.
Okay, thank you, too.
And Robin, we'll go back to Chicago in a minute, but just to underscore how difficult his situation is, we learned today that Donzel did not get that job at Chipotle that he had mentioned. He is, however, optimistic about another opportunity.
Okay, well, before we move on, your personal observation.
Yeah, I mean, it was a really interesting interview to do, and I think one of the things that may not come across is just how young he is. I'm looking across the table at this kid who just got out of prison, and you can see a photo of Donzel, by the way, at hereandnow.org. In a minute, we're going to talk with the woman who runs that cafe where Donzel works, and we will speak with a Southside pastor who is trying to stop the violence in Chicago.
Okay. And we're also watching the news for you. Today, the U.S. military is releasing more information on its plan to open combat roles for women. Women will be allowed to apply to be Army Rangers in 2015, Navy SEALs in 2016. House Republicans are expected to pass a ban on most abortions after 20 weeks. That's the toughest restriction ever, but the bill is not expected to pass the Senate. And the White House and NASA announced they're turning to crowdsourcing to track asteroids. It's the latest public-private partnership, like mapping the human genome. So we're keeping an eye on all of this. You are caught up. Back with Jeremy's visit to Chicago in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back. I'm Robin Young. Our new co-host Jeremy Hobson has been looking at violence in Chicago.
Yeah, Robin, before the break, I spoke with Donzel Mintz, a 21-year-old who just got out of prison. He's working at Kurt's Cafe in Evanston, Illinois, a cafe that employs troubled youth. And a woman named Susan Treishman opened that cafe a year ago. She has made it her mission to give people like Donzel a second chance.
I think we've had 18 kids come through in our first year, and most of them are either job placed or in college or back at high school. We've lost a couple, but just a few, and some have rotated back twice already. But we haven't lost many to the justice system, which is our goal, is to keep them all out of the justice system.
And so the ones who have succeeded have gone on to do what?
We have a kid at Starbucks that just called me and said he thinks he wants to apply for a management position there, which is very exciting. We have a kid who was a driver for Eco Cleaners, and now he got a more stable job just as of this week at Office Depot. We have a kid who got back into high school, two that have gotten into college.
So that must feel great when they end up going on and doing that.
It does. It feels wonderful. Every little success feels good, though. Once we get a kid to commit to coming here and he makes it here 3 days in a row on time, that feels really good. We go on the little victories here. When a kid gets an interview and survives through it, that's a really good feeling. We have a student that got his own apartment. That felt amazing. We all were able to donate stuff so we could have a beautiful first apartment. Every little victory here we celebrate because it's important. These kids have been held back for a long time.
Where did the idea come from?
I do restorative justice work, which is nonviolent mediation, and I kept hearing a lot of kids say that if they just have jobs, they wouldn't get arrested. They just need jobs.
But of course, it's difficult for them to get jobs if they've got a history.
It's impossible. If they have a history, if they're African American, if they're uneducated, they have everything against them. So what I'm trying to do here, with the help of a million volunteers, is we're trying to build their life skills up so they have the confidence to try to get a job. They all come in saying they want to be dishwashers, and by the time they leave, they want to be doctors or physics or chemists. So it's pretty exciting once they see what's out there, once they see they're capable of doing things.
So from the rest of the country, when we look at Chicago right now, one of the big stories that's out there all the time is the fact that there are real problems with violence all over the city. And I wonder, when you see that from here, and especially in the context of what you're doing, do you see a solution that everyone else is not coming to, that if we only did this, this trend would go down?
I wish I had the solution. I think what we don't do is we don't listen to the kids, and we don't even listen to the adult gang members. They have the solution. Every time that we meet with them, we talk at them. We need to listen to them, and then I think we can come to a conclusion together. I don't think it'll be a perfect answer, but I think we'd be a lot better than we are at right now. Most of our students do have anger issues, and we really just put them in a place where they can share why they're angry. And I spent maybe 2.5 hours today talking to a kid about not hitting other people, learning how to man up and walk away from a fight. And it was a 2-hour conversation that didn't go real far, but we'll try again tomorrow.
That was Susan Treishman, who runs Kurtz Cafe in Evanston, Illinois, outside Chicago. Let's turn now to Pastor Corey Brooks of the New Beginnings Church on the south side of Chicago. Pastor Brooks, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on the show today. I greatly appreciate it.
Well, it's great to have you. And I first want to get your thoughts on what we just heard from Susan, that people aren't listening to the kids who are involved in the violence. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. A lot of these kids are angry, frustrated, depressed, and they're trying to express their views the best way that they possibly can, but I don't think that people are listening to them as much as we should. We have to turn an ear toward them and be more attentive and affirming them so that they can go on to be productive and have productive lives. So I agree 100% that we have to do a better job at listening to these children.
Well, what are you hearing from them? I assume you're listening to them.
Yeah, I hear a lot of frustration, a lot of hurt. A lot of them come from broken homes and absent fathers, and for a lot of them, trying to communicate that is even difficult. But when they do communicate it, they express a lot of hurt and a lot of anger and a lot of frustration, and they want to do better. They just don't know how. And so when I talk to young people, I hear a lot of the hurt, a lot of frustration, a lot of desiring to want to go to another level in their life, but just really not having the tools.
What do you think about what we heard from Donzel Mintz, the 21-year-old, who now is an ex-felon? He's not going to have an easy time getting back into the workforce, but he wants to desperately.
Well, first of all, I want to commend him because there are a lot of young men like him who come out of the system with felonies and they go back to a life of crime simply because they think that they cannot achieve or that they cannot go on to be productive citizens. And so for Donzel to even believe that it's possible, that's where it starts. As long as he believes and keeps believing and keeps trying, ultimately he will succeed. But a lot of it has to do with the mentality of the person. If that person thinks that there's no chances, no opportunities for them, then they're going to act like there's no chances and no opportunities. But when a person believes that things can get better, that they can be successful, that they can make it, then their actions will show that. And that's exactly what we're seeing in Donzel. He believes that he can make it. And because he has that belief, I have no doubt that he's going to be okay.
Pastor Brooks, one more thing. I mean, if people take one thing away from this, what needs to be done right now to deal with this violence problem in Chicago?
Well, we have to collaborate and work together. I tell people we have to gang up on the problem and stop gang up on each other. We have to all come together, parents, preachers, politicians, police, all of us working together to make sure that we solve this issue. We have to do what we can do in our territories, in our areas, to make sure that we make life better. I know here where we are, we're trying to collaborate and work with people by building a community center.
Right.
And we believe that community center is going to help some children to be more successful and to succeed.
Pastor Corey Brooks runs the New Beginnings Church on the south side of Chicago. Pastor Brooks, thanks so much.
Thank you. I greatly appreciate it.
Okay, and our listeners in Chicago, your thoughts on the recent peak in violence there? This past weekend, the deadliest of the year, 7 killed. Let us know your thoughts. Possible solutions at hereandnow.org. And by the way, throw something out. It's just terrible weekend in Chicago. But Jeremy, we're going to be hearing tomorrow about the deadliest city in the world. I want to throw that out to listeners. Of course, you can Google it. And you may have heard this in NPR's terrific recent reporting. But what do you think is the deadliest city in the world?
Good question.
We are going to answer it tomorrow. Latest news is next, Here and Now.
Tonight could be the end of a long season for LeBron James and the Miami Heat. The team faces elimination in Game 6 of the NBA Finals against the San Antonio Spurs, who currently lead the best-of-seven series 3-2. And the big question is, can LeBron overcome his playoff inconsistencies and lead the Heat to their second straight championship? Phil Latzman is a longtime Heat watcher, first as host for Miami Heat Radio. He's now an anchor for WLRN Miami Herald News. He joins us from Miami. And Phil, the mood must be intense there today.
I think the word I would use for it, Jeremy, is vexing, because this team, which was so good in the regular season, was toying with opponents during that 27-game win streak, has now not been able to win back-to-back games in either the Eastern Conference Finals or the NBA Finals. I mean, this was supposed to be the most dominant team built to win championships. And, you know, tonight's Game 6 is really, I think, a referendum on whether or not LeBron James's decision to play in Miami has worked thus far, because, you know, they lost in 2011. They were in a similar situation against the Dallas Mavericks. They won last year in the NBA Finals. They won 4 straight after losing the opener to Oklahoma City. And they were wondering which team is going to show up tonight. I mean, I've never, ever seen, in all my years of covering and watching sports, such an inconsistent series. There's no trends. The only trend that you have in this series is that Danny Green and the Spurs seem to be knocking down open three-point shots. But other than that, you just don't know what team is going to show up.
Well, what happened here, Phil? I mean, is it LeBron, or is it about Chris Bosh and Dwayne Wade, the other two members of this big three?
Well, I think it's partially that LeBron is a very unselfish player. I mean, he would prefer to pass first. And a lot of times, Heat fans watch the games and go, why did you pass it there? You penetrated, got in the lane, you had a shot, and then you decided to swing the ball outside. It's a combination. Dwayne Wade had looked like a guy that could be on crutches, you know, in an old age home earlier in the series, and then all of a sudden comes out and scores 32 points in Game 4. The big three is back. Bosh is aggressive. And, you know, he, I don't think, has lived up to the big contract that he got from the Heat when he signed here. So it's a combination of the three of them not really jibing on each night, but LeBron would rather pass the ball than shoot it, and I think that he's going to have to change that strategy for tonight. He should be taking charge and being more aggressive and shooting the ball a lot more and taking over.
Well, give us a sense of the stakes, especially for people who don't follow this very closely. I mean, people have compared LeBron James to Michael Jordan. Some say he is better than Michael Jordan was. He started his NBA career much earlier, but if they lose tonight, if the Miami Heat lose tonight, he's going to be behind Jordan when it comes to championships at this point in their careers.
Well, I mean, it's easy. I mean, Michael Jordan, you know, won 6 NBA championships.
Right. But by the time he was 30, he had already won 3, I think.
Right. If he loses in this NBA Finals, you know, remember the one he lost in Cleveland in 2007, that's 3 out of 4 times he's made it to the NBA Finals and lost, and then people are going to start to question whether he is the big game player that everyone thought he was. You know, kind of the way that Alex Rodriguez was with the New York Yankees. He's won 1 World Series with the Yankees, but, you know, is he really the big game guy? And, you know, if LeBron loses this and does not come up with another championship, because remember, the press conference they had 3 years ago here was, well, not 1, not 2, not 3, not 4, and then they went on to 7 championships. I mean, the expectations are so high here, Jeremy, that if they don't win back-to-back titles, that is a disappointment. And just just one final note on this. I don't have the stats in front of you, but if you look at the stats, points, rebounds, and assists, LeBron's stats are better than Michael Jordan's stats. But the only stat that counts is championships. Michael has six of them. LeBron right now only has one.
So a lot on the line here. And what happens if they lose? I mean, do you think that the big three split up?
Well, LeBron James has a out in his contract after next season. There's already been talk that if he's not happy here, he might go back to Cleveland or wherever. Chris,
if
Bosch,
they'll take him.
Chris Bosh has been a disappointment here, and there's already been rumors even before this series is over that the Heat might be looking to trade him. So, yeah, I think this is the referendum on whether the Miami Heat are a dynasty basketball team or they're just your average team, a good team that won a championship. The legacy implications are huge.
And I see a lot of people in Miami are doing some good luck charms, a lot of superstition going on today. Phil Latzman, senior anchor reporter at the WLRN Miami Herald News, host of the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Phil, thanks so much and enjoy the game.
My pleasure, Jeremy. Go Heat.
And Robin's got a look at Iran's new president-elect in 30 seconds, here and now.
So what is really true about the just-elected president of Iran? Is Hassan Rouhani the moderate his supporters say he is? Moderates were out celebrating over the weekend. President Obama had this to say about the election in his interview with Charlie Rose.
The Iranian people rebuffed the hardliners and the clerics in the election who were counseling no compromise on anything, anytime, anywhere. Clearly, you have a hunger within Iran to engage with the international community in a more positive way.
And in Hassan Rouhani's first press conference yesterday, he pledged to follow a path of moderation and justice, not extremism. But he also said no direct talks until the U.S. respects Iran's nuclear rights. The Iranians say they are not making weapons. And lists sanctions. Author Reza Aslan is founder of Aslan Media, which covers the greater Middle East. Reza, welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
And what are you hearing from Iranians in Iran and here in the U.S.?
Well, there's certainly a sense of excitement about Rouhani's election. And the president is partly right. It is a repudiation of some of the hard-line policies of the Ahmadinejad presidency, but it isn't exactly a repudiation of the clerics. In fact, Hassan Rouhani himself is a cleric, one of the founders of the Islamic Republic. If you want to talk about a repudiation of the clerical system, then you have to go back to Ahmadinejad, whose policies were probably the most anti-clerical of any president in Iran's history.
Remind us, why would that be? Because we remember he was often in butting heads with the clerics, but why?
First of all, Ahmadinejad was the first non-cleric to become president of Iran since the first president of Iran, who only lasted about a year and a half in office before being impeached. In fact, he's probably made the office a legitimate base of power in a way that it had never been under any of his predecessors. And he also routinely challenged the authority of the supreme leader. In fact, he went so far as to publicly say that the Islamic Republic is too complex of a thing to be run by the clerics, which is why he had so many enemies within the clerical regime.
So see, right there, this complicates things because you are now saying that the newly elected president who takes office in early August, Hassan Rouhani, is a cleric. Tell us more about him. Who is he?
Hassan Rouhani, as I say, is one of the founders of the Islamic Republic, a very close confidant of Ayatollah Khomeini, someone who has been in the government for really most of his life. And I guess if there's one thing to say about Hassan Rouhani is that he has a very broad base of support, probably more so than any president in recent history. The clerical groups, because he himself is a cleric, the so-called pragmatists, who want to have greater relations with the West and with Europe, want to privatize industry and open up the economy in Iran. And then now, thanks to the support of people like former President Mohammad Khatami, he's managed to also rally the so-called reformists under his camp. Now, one can say that that's a lot of different factions that he can ultimately disappoint, but nevertheless, he's starting out with some good footing in that he has enormous popular support across a wide range of socioeconomic and political groups.
But Reza, explain to us why that is, because as you just said, he's so tied to the Islamic regime in the past. So why was it in the run-up to the elections, I remember reading this, many Iranians, the moderates, were thinking of boycotting, and then they suddenly thought that this one candidate might win, and they flocked to the polls. Quite exciting. What do moderates see in him?
Well, partly it had to do with a very clever campaign. I mean, Hassan Rouhani really came out of nowhere in the last few days of the election, primarily because he repudiated the failed economic policies of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and that really got him the support of the centrists and the pragmatists. He talked about the privatization of industry. At the same time, he boldly went after the regime and really did something that was taboo in Iran. He talked about Karoubi and Mousavi, the leaders of the Green Movement in 2009. He called for the release of political prisoners from that election process. At the same time, however, he was very careful never to directly criticize either the supreme leader or the clerical hierarchy that really runs Iran. So he gave them sort of the confidence to know that despite this wave of popular support for his election, that he's not someone who's going to challenge the fundamental religio-political nature of the regime the way that Ahmadinejad did.
So where do you think this goes, in particular when it comes to the nuclear calculation? Rouhani says he will not suspend the country's nuclear program, which, by the way, he did in 2004 as a negotiator to build trust at that point with negotiators. He said those days are over. But you have President Obama saying that the sanctions will stay in place until Iran abandons its pursuit of a nuclear weapon, which, of course, the U.S. believes Iran is doing.
It's important to understand that the president has very little power when it comes to policy decisions. The supreme leader in Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, is going to make all decisions when it comes to foreign policy and when it comes to the nuclear negotiations. That said, everybody knows how we go forward from here. Iran has made it very clear what it wants. It wants a public declaration from the United States of its right to enrich uranium as a signatory of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and it wants a roadmap in which the sanctions are removed. It wants to know what the final outcome is if Iran does suspend its nuclear program. On the American side, of course, we want greater access to Iran's nuclear program, particularly some of its military bases at places like Fordo, and we would like a cap on Iran's enrichment and, of course, a shipping out of the country of all of Iran's nuclear stockpile. In other words, everybody knows what's on the table. Everybody knows how to move forward. It's just having the political will on both sides to make the necessary compromises to do so. And hopefully, with a President Obama that is halfway through a second term, not worried about reelection, and a President Rouhani who has this broad base of support and a much more moderate outlook, the path is now set whereby we can take the steps necessary to bring this nuclear impasse to an end.
That's Reza Aslan, the founder of Aslan Media and an author and commentator. And Reza, we always appreciate your insight. Thank you so much.
Anytime.
A quick check on some business news today. Starbucks is trying to stay one step ahead of the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. And that means starting next week, you will know just how many calories are in that venti double chocolate chip frappuccino. Starbucks has decided to start posting calorie counts. The FDA is expected to put out rules next year that would force restaurants with more than 20 locations to post that kind of information. But many chains, Robin, are trying to get out in front of the regulations by starting their own labeling policies. And, you know, in New York City, it's already the rule that they have to do this. As soon as I found out that the chocolate chip M&M cookie I used to get at Starbucks was, 4,000 calories? I stopped doing it. But as for that double chocolatey chip frappuccino, it is 670 calories. Speaking of calories, by the way, up next here and now, resident chef Kathy Gunst will join us and give us the scoop on some of the best ice cream, frozen yogurt, and gelato out there. We're back in a minute, here and now.
Jeremy, are you ready? Because you are now going to deal with the most difficult part of your
job. Uh-oh. Yeah. What is that?
I kid. We're going to talk food.
Oh, good.
I'm going to have a small brownie sundae with mint patty yogurt, nuts, chocolate jimmies, hot fudge, and a cherry on that.
Oh, can you imagine? Here now, resident chef Kathy Gunst went recently to her local ice cream hangout, Aggie's Ice Cream in South Berwick, Maine.
What's your favorite kind of ice cream?
Vanilla.
What are you going to get tonight? Pineapple.
What are you guys having tonight?
A coffee Oreo.
What else do you like?
Cookie dough, Reese's, cookies and cream.
And what kind of ice cream are you eating tonight?
Chocolate.
Is that the kind you get always?
Mm-hmm.
Do you do this a lot?
3 times a week.
Wow. And do you always get the same flavor?
Yeah, mostly. Coffee, yogurt.
Coffee, yogurt.
I get yogurt because if I eat ice cream 3 times a week, I'd...
But is that thinking correct, that if it's yogurt, you can eat it 3 times a week? Yogurt, ice cream, gelato, sorbet. What's the difference? Kathy Gunz joins us in the studio. Kathy, Jeremy, Jeremy, Kathy.
Hey, nice
Jeremy.
To meet you, especially under these circumstances.
Yeah, I hear you are a food man.
I love my ice cream.
We're going to get along brilliantly.
Well, so Kathy, what did you get that night?
Oh, this is embarrassing because I will eat the weirdest raw fish. I will eat any type of food anywhere in the world. But when it comes to ice cream, vanilla.
Vanilla.
Vanilla. I know. It's like, how boring can it be? But I'm sorry. It's been that way since I was one.
You know what? I'm so with you.
Seriously?
Really?
Yeah. But yo, yeah, I am. What
are
about you
doing? I'm a mint chocolate chip guy.
Okay, that's
myself.
My number two.
Well, I mean, it's not like that.
And I'm not working this.
You know, that's right. And it's not like that's sort of outrageous, you know? But
that seems almost vanilla, really, in the context of ice cream.
Can I just tell you a very quick story, which will date me? When I was a kid in the suburbs of New York, the Good Humor truck would come, and all the kids would get a quarter. And my dad was a junk food king, and he would give us a $20 bill. Okay, this is in the 60s, so imagine a $20. That would be like giving your kid a $100 bill, and he'd say, get a box. So we were an ice cream family.
By the way, just since you brought that Good Humor truck up, I have a friend who told me that his mother, when the ice cream truck would come by and play the music, his mother used to tell him that meant they were out of ice cream. So they never
That's
had to
great.
Buy it.
And to me, the jingle of the truck is summer.
Right, it's like the siren.
Well, exactly. Kathy, tell us about this stand, because it demonstrates, I gather, one of the trends that you're seeing.
Well, Aggie's is a very old-fashioned kind of place. They have over 100 flavors, and it's the place all the kids in town go to after softball practice, after baseball games, after soccer practice, long line. It's just so old-fashioned.
Everybody has one.
The trend now is way different. It's really interesting, bizarre flavors. They're boozy popsicles, margarita mint, agave and lime. And even at that old-fashioned ice cream stand in a small town in southern Maine, they have some wacky flavors. 16-year-old Georgia Barlow introduces us.
For the past 2 years, there's been a new one. Salted caramel chocolate pretzel or Graham Central Station. Those are some of the more like exotic ones. Right now, there's Twinkie cake, which seems, that's a common reaction from a lot of people. But that's probably one of the weirder ones, in my opinion.
A Twinkie? I mean,
I think I'll pass.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I'm the one who ate, was it roasted Twinkie on a stick or something at a fair
it's
once?
It's made just for you.
So give us a primer. You've got ice cream that you've
I do.
In.
We're going to have a little taste
it's
test
It's melting
here.
Right now,
it is.
By
so,
the way.
Oh, I think Jeremy's hungry. All right, let's start with this one. Ready? For the vanilla queen, I'm going to send this one over.
Thank you.
This is frozen yogurt. Now, I'm about to blow the roof off this stuff because I love frozen yogurt, and like so many, I always believed that it was super, super healthy. Do you remember the episode from Seinfeld?
Oh, yeah, let's listen.
How good is this?
It's good.
How good?
Very good.
I know.
They put real blueberries in it. Real blueberries. What kind did you get?
Coffee. And they grind up the coffee beans and put it in.
Let me taste that.
Huh? Huh?
Que rico.
Suave. And it's non-fat.
How could this not have any fat? It's too good.
And, of course, they take it to the lab, right, and find out that, in fact, it does have fat in it. Kathy, is there any such thing as a healthy frozen yogurt?
Well, there is, but I'll tell you, there are these chains now. You know, I was just in New York City on every other... Do you hear the scraping of the spoons?
Tell me that the
You're
one
supposed
I...
You're supposed to save a bite for me, Robin.
Yeah, Robin, that's a joke. The problem with frozen yogurt these days is that it is filled with preservatives, and the fact of the matter is that a whole lot of it is no less caloric than ice cream. Ask next time you go to one of these chains what's in that frozen yogurt. It's a little bit terrifying. I'm not going to mention brand names, but you should definitely ask to see the list of ingredients. So, Robin, you have vanilla yogurt there.
That's well, I had.
Had, okay. Sorry, Jeremy. That's 40 calories per ounce. You might want to slow down. Okay, that's not low fat. Okay, that's a little bit less than some ice creams.
Okay.
Jeremy, you have lemon sorbetto, which is an Italian version of a sorbet, and that is a vegan treat that has dairy in it whatsoever. And what's fabulous is when you take the dairy out, you really taste the flavor.
Well, wait, so again, what's sorbet?
It's generally a softer frozen treat, but it contains no dairy generally, and it's not whipped. So it's a non-fat or lower-fat alternative to traditional ice cream or gelato.
So you're giving me license to eat this entire thing.
I think you should go nuts. Exactly.
Pound.
Robin, on the other hand, is having the delusional treat, which is the frozen yogurt that's really not exactly healthy.
Well, you mentioned gelato. What's
I mentioned
that?
Gelato. Okay, you ready?
Yeah.
Here's vanilla for the, you know, the boring one. This is Nutella for Jeremy.
Mm.
Okay, let me just tell you. Gelato, in general, is an Italian ice cream. It's made from water and milk, and it's combined with flavors and sweeteners. It comes from the Italian word for frozen. So how is it different than regular ice cream? It's all about butter, fat, and density. So unlike a traditional ice cream, gelato, there's no air whipped into it. So it's a denser, more intensely flavored frozen treat. Gelato's said to have less fat, and generally it is. Most gelato has 4 to 8% butter fat, and ice cream, U.S. ice cream, generally has 10 to 18%.
Mm. Well, because when you see gelato in the display cases at an ice cream place, it actually looks different in the
tin in the case. It's those European displays, but it looks kind of whipped and silky, and it's very seductive. And when you eat ice cream, too, you often hear chefs talk about mouthfeel. So how is it coating your mouth? Like, Jeremy, you have the Nutella. The flavor really comes through.
Mm, yes.
If it were an ice cream with cream and eggs and what traditional ice cream has, it would be more subtle.
My mouth is frozen. I can't taste anything.
All right, let's move along.
Yes,
okay?
Because we know you have made ice cream.
I make ice cream all the time. I have an ice cream maker. It's an extremely easy thing. However, I know people are out there listening going, I'm not making ice cream. I got four
ice
cream places.
I'm saying that right
here. Okay, great. Here you go. This is called granita. It's like an Italian ice, like a quick slushy. Can you reach it there? This is lemongrass and watermelon. I made it last night. It took me 10 minutes. Mm. You make a sugar syrup, water and sugar, and I threw in some fresh lemongrass, which is a stalk of an Asian spice. You can add grated lemon zest. And I added 4 cups of watermelon that I pureed, and I stuck it in a metal pan, and I froze it, and then I slushed it around, and I froze it some more, and it's so refreshing. And that, you know exactly what's in it. 4 cups of fruit, a little bit of sugar syrup. Mm. You could add fresh basil with strawberries. You could do a blueberry peppercorn. You can get nutso, or you can go straight down the line and do something, you know, fresh peaches when they're in season.
Okay, so that's a granita.
And I got to say, by the way, out of all of these, I think I'm a gelato person.
Okay.
I think that's the direction I'm going to be going behind your back.
That Jeremy, you know?
Such a snob.
He screams gelato.
Well, we're going to have the recipe for watermelon, lemongrass, granita, and more at herenow.org. As we thank Kathy Gunst for talking ice cream as we start our summer. Kathy, thanks as always.
Good way for the summer to start.
Thanks, Kathy.
Bye, Jeremy. See you soon.
See you soon.
Ice cream, you sing. Everybody wants ice cream.
So, Jeremy, we close every program with hosts eating ice cream.
Good. I like that idea.
Actually, don't get used to this. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Join us again, Here and Now.